Welcome to the first episode of the FAIR Podcast. The Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice. To learn more about FAIR or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. I'm Blair Hodges, host of the FAIR Podcast. In this episode, I'll be talking with Greg Smith, a FAIR volunteer and family care physician who lives in Canada. Greg has done a lot of writing on the FAIR Wiki and has published several responses to books in the Farm's Review. His 2009 FAIR conference presentation, Everything You Wanted to Know About Plural Marriage But Were Afraid to Ask, is available at fairlds.org. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Welcome to the inaugural podcast for FAIR, the Foundation of Apologetic Information Research. I'm here with Greg Smith from Canada. Hello, Greg.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became an apologist.
I was born and raised in southern Alberta in Canada. Southern Alberta was settled by, or a lot of little towns here were settled by Mormons who headed north from Utah kind of in the 1880s in the wake of the polygamy difficulties that they were having with the U.S. federal government. They also sent some to Mexico, as most people know, but fewer people are aware. They sent some to Canada. And the idea, I think, was A, to have people in an area outside the reach of the federal government, and B, to probably prepare places that, you know, the rest of the church could flee to if push came to shove. I think they'd had enough of being driven out of places and heading to where there was nothing. So it's a lot, in some ways, culturally at least, it's a lot like Utah in a way. You know, little small towns, fairly rural. It's probably a lot like southern Utah is. So that's where I grew up, and I'm a family doctor. I served my mission for the church in Paris, France from 1991 to 93. And I now practice rural family medicine in the little town I grew up in.
Where did you go to school for that?
I went to school. All my schooling was done at the University of Alberta, which is in Edmonton. It's about 6 hours north of where I am now, so it's about 7 hours due north of Montana. So very much the Great White North. And then I did my residency in family medicine in Montreal in association with McGill University.
Okay.
So
cool.
I speak French and English. I'm on the list of, you know, I can practice medicine in French or English. So, which, believe it or not, you even need in a little town like this.
Sure. Talk to me a little bit about apologetics, as far as how you became involved in apologetics for the church.
Yeah. Well, very much accidentally, I suppose. I don't even particularly like the label apologist. Not that it offends me in any way. It's just it seems to me having a label for something that we all do. I mean, everybody is an apologist for a great many things, you know, be it our political views, be it our religious views, whatever opinions we have. If we set them out in any kind of a formal or semi-rational fashion, that's apologetics. So I always find it amusing when critics will say, well, why should we listen to the apologist? Well, they're as much an apologist for whatever they believe as I am, and so is everyone else on the planet, you know. So, but how I got into the, you know, kind of talking about attacks on the church, I was assigned by my bishop when I was in Edmonton to help a sister who had been hit with kind of all the standard sectarian anti-Mormon stuff. And so I kind of boned up a little bit. I suppose that was my first exposure. It was all pretty pedestrian stuff in retrospect, you know, just changes to the Book of Mormon text or prophets not being perfect, all that sort of thing. Nothing really too shocking there. So I suppose that piqued my interest a bit, and I maybe read around it a little bit more, but it wasn't really a big something that I spent a lot of time on. Then after I finished my training, we had a bit of an outbreak of what you might call secular anti-Mormon stuff going on up here in Canada, which was in the newspapers and stuff, which kind of got my attention a little bit more, just because it was somewhat closer to home. And so that's probably where I, without really knowing why, I began to just kind of write stuff up about this and just save it to my hard drive. Not that I had any plans to do anything with it. I just had memories of this assignment from my bishop years ago, and he was saying, go over and talk to this sister, and me going, oh, geez, I don't have anything to bring her. So I figured, well, I better write some stuff just in case anyone asks me about this stuff. And then a family member I knew said, you know, there's this group FAIR that, you know, you might actually like. So I joined that, and the rest, as they say, is history or infamy, I guess.
And since then, what kind of things have you done for FAIR specifically?
Oh, I try to help out wherever I can. I suppose the first thing I did, I hadn't been a member of the list. You know, we have a list where we try to answer questions that people write in about. I hadn't been a member for very long when I kind of dumped this 50 or 60 page paper with 300 footnotes on the management committee. It was on plural marriage, just because we didn't have much on it. And so it was kind of one of those, well, fools and idiots rush in where angels fear to tread. And I did something on it and sent it in, and I said, you know, I don't know if this is any good. I don't know if this is any use. Tell me what you think and I won't be offended. And so some of them read it, and then Alan Wyatt got back to me, who's a professional editor, and he says, well, you know, there's good stuff here, but you need to, he had some stylistic suggestions, which I took and essentially rewrote it, and which helped enormously, I might add. And so that was probably the first thing I did is plural marriage, just, which again I fell into accidentally more than anything, just because no one was really doing much with it. So I just kind of started looking into it on my own. After that, we started the FAIR Wiki, which appealed to me enormously because I had all this stuff that I'd been saving up that I had kind of squirreled away on my hard drive. You know, I had links to various things, and you know, this was my just-in-case file, so I wouldn't be caught flat-footed if I got this assignment again. And so the wiki was a great place to just kind of dump all this material and add to it, and I'm just obsessive-compulsive enough that I kept working at it. And so that's probably been the biggest long-term project I've done is just trying to get the wiki into the shape that it is.
And you mentioned plural marriage. I think that's one of the common things that we hear people ask about as far as you know, what plural marriage was about. There's a lot of people in the church who can get stuck on that particular issue. Now, what are some of the problems that you've found people have had with plural marriage that have maybe talked to you about it, or questions that you've seen come into FAIR? What's bothering people about plural marriage?
Well, anything and everything, I suppose. We don't seem to have a problem in the church realizing that Brigham Young was a polygamist. That seems to be fairly firmly fixed in our minds. But some people aren't even aware that Joseph was. I don't really understand how that could be. I certainly believe it when people tell me they were of that view, because when I was on my mission, we were teaching a gentleman in English, and we had a couple of senior missionaries, and this investigator asked us and said, now, did Joseph Smith practice plural marriage? And I said, yes, he did, at the same time that the senior couple said, no, he most certainly did not. And I was the senior companion, so I couldn't look to my junior companion for any help here. And I said, well, I'm pretty sure he did, you know. I was pretty sure. And no, absolutely not, they said. And the investigator says to me, he says, now, Elder Smith, you know this book backward and forward. He was waving the Book of Mormon here. He says, so you tell me, did he practice it or not? And I said, well, it's not in there, but I'm pretty sure he did, but I'll get back to you. So I called the mission president and said, am I crazy? And he said, no, you're not crazy. Joseph did practice plural marriage. And I said, okay, thank you. That's all I wanted to know. So you know, and this couple had been in the church their whole lives. So if they didn't know, I'm certain they were not the only ones.
Yeah, I honestly can't remember when I first heard about it.
Exactly.
It had to have been when I was very young, but I can't. But I, too, have met people who say that they've grown up in the church and they've never heard about it. And every time I'm shocked, but I believe them.
Yeah, exactly. I've met enough that it does. That said, I mean, there's other much more basic gospel principles that I've met people who don't understand either. So, I you know, we're all at different places, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess if there's one thing you maybe don't need to understand right now, it's probably that. But once the cat's out of the bag, then I guess that's when it can become...
That's right, because it suddenly opens this huge, huge thing that... I think, as I thought about it, I've tried to reflect on why this is maybe such a problem for us, and I think... it all boils down to, in a sense, that at first blush, certainly, and maybe even second or third blush, depending what's happening, it really looks like the worst things about religion, you know, about all religion, you know. It really looks like someone with a great deal of religious and temporal power convincing people to... either offer themselves or their daughters or their wives or whoever to them sexually, you know, and we've all heard a thousand stories about quote-unquote cult leaders or various gurus. I myself, as a psychiatry practice, have treated, you know, people coming out of that sort of a situation, people who were whose parents went off and followed a rather unique, shall we say, religious path, and their kids ended up getting molested and everything by the guru, you know. So I have some personal experience with what that's like, at least from a professional point of view. So I think that's, when you boil it all down, even if people don't articulate it that way, I think that drives a lot of it. And I think it's especially difficult if, because it summons up all those sorts of images, you know, priesthood leaders in the church who maybe haven't treated us the way they should have, or women who feel they've been slighted or put down, and this looks like that, just, you know, to the nth degree. So I think that's what it really comes down to, is that at first blush, as soon as you start mixing sex and religion in any form, people get suspicious, and rightfully so, I think.
I think one reason that it continues to be a concern is just our doctrine of sealing, and I think there is that idea of, well, you know, is it technically still continuing? Is that something that can still happen even though we don't practice?
Right, is this lurking in my future, or...
Right, what would your response be there?
Well, again, my first response would be to say, well, the people that I've heard who think that's a good idea, it's usually the guy who sits on the back row of Sunday school and rabble rouses, you know, who chooses that moment to announce how this is coming back for sure and the sisters had better get used to it, and sits back with a somewhat self-satisfied look. I always try to say to sisters, even if it did come back, that sort of person is probably not going to be the one practicing it. So you can put your mind at ease there. I think I would go back to the idea that the gospel is good news. It is always good news. It's always better than we think. So if there's something about that that troubles us, if we think that that's going to come and that that's going to be a problem in the hereafter, let's say, I would just say, you know what, that means we don't understand it. We don't get it. And I think it's the sort of thing that, if you trust God, you know, don't worry, these things are going to work out. That would kind of be my first run at it. After that, I'd say, well, you know, what is it about it that worries you particularly, and then try to target it a bit more at what their concern was. Personally, I don't think it's ever coming back in this lifetime, because if one of the things that I've become very strongly convinced of is that one of its purposes was to set us at odds or in tension with the host culture we found ourselves in. You know, Mormons were not that different culturally or politically or anything else, or religiously, really, in their values from the American society in which they were. And you, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your point of view, you need a moderate degree of tension with your host culture to establish a new religion, to establish a kind of culture there. And I think plural marriage was a way to do that. It definitely set us at odds. Nobody liked us because of it. And yet it spared us because of distance and location. You know, we didn't get the persecutions of the 30s or 40s, you know. I mean, sure, they weren't always nice to the Mormons out in Utah, but there were very, very few deaths. You know, it was a good way to do that. So, I mean, these days, I don't think most of society would care one way or the other if, you know, people don't care about serial monogamy or one-night stands. You know, we would look tame by comparison, I think. So from that point of view, I can't ever see it coming back in this life. But that's just a personal spin on it.
Okay. Another question kind of around that same topic, then, is someone came to you and was to say, well, oh, that's God just using women for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you've read any of the journals or any of the diaries from the men and the women.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, even, you could argue that in some ways the men had things to deal with that the women didn't. I do think, on balance, that it was probably a greater trial to the women than the men, but at least the women could not be painted as lascivious or doing this for their own purposes. Nobody was convinced that the women, you know, were somehow motivated by base motives, or that this was, you know, somehow wish fulfillment on their part. But, you know, you look at what they said about Brigham Young and John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff and all the men, you know, it was looked at as this was just free sex, and, you know, the Mormons had taken the basest instincts of mankind and married it to religion. You know, and that's a very difficult thing to respond to, even if it's not true. How do you, you know, to a hostile audience, how do you convince them that that isn't the case? I think the writing of those men makes it clear in the main that it certainly was not the case, but That's a tough burden to bear. You know, I respect them for that because they really probably had no good answer to that charge at the time that would be persuasive to anybody who wasn't going to be persuaded on other grounds.
Now, last year at the Fair Conference, you gave a presentation about plural marriage. You talked about for quite a while, and during the course of that presentation, you mentioned that you hadn't started out to be the person that people would ask about plural marriage. You hadn't set out to be an expert on that, but this is something that kind of grew out of your own research. And you said when you first started to look into this, you said you had to consecrate your mind. That's the phrase that you use, consecrate your mind or your brain, before you started the process. Can you talk a little bit about what you meant by that?
Yeah, well, it wasn't at the beginning of the process. I mean, the first thing I read about it was, it's funny, all growing up, you know, my parents had a lot of books, and all growing up, my dad had a copy of Van Wagener's Mormon Polygamy, A History, you know, which was probably the first, you know, book-length treatment of it back in the mid-80s by Signature Books. And it sat on his bookshelf, and I saw it many times, and there were many times, and I read a lot, and so there were many times when I thought, oh, you know, Mormon Polygamy, that sounds kind of interesting, I should read that. And I always felt uncomfortable about the idea of reading it, which is really strange, because I will read anything. I mean, heck, I'll read 19th century anti-Mormon literature. You know, that proves my standards are not that high. And certainly nothing, my parents had never said, don't read this book, or, you know, I mean, my dad telling you not to read a book, that would be like that just isn't going to happen, you know. I remember when I was fairly young, one of my uncles came over to the house and saw a book that my dad had. It was by I think it was by Hans Tung, the Christian theologian, and he said, oh, good grief, what's your dad reading that for? And I said, oh, gee, I don't know. So later on, I asked my dad that question. I said, you know, Uncle so-and-so wondered why you're reading this book, and my dad laughed, and he said, well, you can't know a book's not worth reading unless you've read it. And so that was very much, you know, kind of the environment I grew up in. So, but I always felt uncomfortable about reading it, and I never did. I went to do it many times and just felt wrong, and I didn't do it. And so then, you know, fast forward 10 years, and I'm starting to get into this, and so I actually went and borrowed that very book and felt fine about reading it, or at least nothing stopped me from reading it. So I read, I was only the first five pages, and like I talked about at the Fair Conference, by the time I was into the first five pages, you know, the author had made it fairly strikingly clear that he regarded Joseph Smith as a womanizer well before plural marriage, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I stopped reading at that point, not because I was afraid of it, I suppose, but because I knew I had enough to chew on. And if there's one thing I believe, it's in, you know, taking your time with this stuff. Just to digress a little bit on that, I think that's the other problem people really run into this, is that they encounter something about this, either on an anti-Mormon website or from a friend or whatever, and they read more and more of it, you know, kind of hoping the story will get better, and it doesn't seem like it does, it gets worse, you know, and so they're hit with this huge mammoth amount of stuff that's bouncing around, you know, and then it becomes very difficult for them to even get kind of the mental peace and clarity to sit down and start addressing these issues, because even if you start to get one, you've got 1,000 more on the back burner, you know. So right. if I did anything right, I suppose in the whole process it was that, is that I knew my limits, and I said, okay, you know, I gotta figure out what I'm gonna do with this. So, you know, I kind of thought about it for a while, and I came to three conclusions fairly quickly. One was is that I didn't know enough to answer the question, you know, was Joseph Smith a womanizer? The evidence I had been presented was really very convincing, and I thought, okay, maybe he was, but if he wasn't, I certainly can't prove that he wasn't. The second thing is I was smart enough, I guess, to know that to answer that question was going to take a lot of time. It was going to take effort and work, and that, you know, I was going to have to buckle down and dig into primary sources and stuff. And the third thing I knew is that I knew that I couldn't put my spiritual life, if you will, or convictions on hold for the amount of time that it would take to answer that question. As it turned out, it probably took me about 6 months of just reading and thinking and reflecting and whatnot before I was in a position that I could have given you a coherent answer to that question. So I was right there, at least, that I didn't have the time. You know, 6 months is an eternity in spiritual matters.